part of the child. And he fashioned out of this the first human being, who therefore had a body of a Titan and a soul of Dionysus. There was a conflict set up between order and chaos within the individual himself. His inner life is order, his outer life is chaos. And if the inner order is polluted or diluted and falls into the keeping of the chaos, all is lost. There is in every living thing a mysterious power derived from deity, which power is capable of bringing the person out of his difficulties and bringing him back again into the patterns of the divine purpose. It is in every living thing. It is not limited to man. It is limited only to that which has a form of any kind, because what is not, which has not a form, is cannot be ensouled, because a soul must dwell in a form. But it may be an invisible form, but it is still there. So in every form, blades of grass, the earth under our feet, the waves of the sea, in everything that exists, there is soul. For soul is that which makes a form possible. A form without soul is matter only. And it is inconceivable that we will ever find pure matter. For soul, it goes into form in every level of existence. Now, the purpose of soul always, as Bamy pointed out, is to use the form which it has, much as it uses the acorn. The form becomes the food of the soul. And through this, the soul is released into growth to grow into a mighty tree, many times the size of the acorn. So every soul has within it this growing factor, growing through body, growing up to a release of itself into the light of truth. Well, people don't seem to pay much attention to souls anymore. They just take for granted that they have an animation somewhere, that there is something in them that lives that makes it possible for them to make mistakes. They don't know what it is. They have no idea what the power of motivation behind them. They do not know what it is that forces creatures to break through the shells of matter and grow, which enables very primitive creatures to maintain the stream of life and to develop more and more purposeful existences. But actually, regardless of how we approach the matter, the individual has within himself this compound of the blood of the dying God, the Christ in you, the hope of glory, and the Titans, or the primordial, uncultivated, undisciplined attitudes and emotions. And whenever anything happens around, we generally let either the mental or the emotional Titans take over. They become more or less giants without soul, without consciousness, without true purpose. They are primordial force and energy, the kind of force that gets behind you when you reach out and strike somebody you do not like. The power to hit another person is the energy of the Titans. And when the power of the soul is blighted by this antagonism, the blow is struck, and the soul remains a prisoner for another period of time, whereas forgiveness would have released the soul and baffled the Titans. So everywhere in us is conflict. St. Augustine pointed this out in his story of the city of God and the city of Babylon. We are a double empire, each of us. One part, as Goethe says in Faust, to the heavens aspires, and the other in the earth suspires. There is conflict in all of us until we mend that conflict by the power of our own inner lives. When soul attains victory, confusion ends. When body gains victory, confusion is worse confounded. So we have to constantly labor to make this adjustment. And the way to make it is to realize that we have to cut clear through an entire world of sophistication. We have to cut through what we like to think of as the grown-up practical world. A world that is growing up, but it's also growing older, so that all the grown-ups will ultimately disappear without being very wise in most cases. We are mistaking a material environment with its classical opportunities, with its skyscrapers, with its tremendous aviations, with its factories and its various colossal industries. We mistake this for something important. Yet not long ago, one of the science editors here in this country said that if by some chance we do get into a nuclear war, there won't be anything left anyway. And yet we consider this world with its very tragically impermanent things and the attitude of people who are making every possible effort to destroy what there is. This is not a world that is ours. This is not a world we can afford to become involved in more than is necessary. We are here not because it is going to be our share to be wealthy or to lead an army to conquer a nation or to use our own arrogance to cause millions of deaths on a battlefield. This is not our purpose. Our purpose, as far as we can make it, is to realize that we are here to experience, and that all true experience makes us more kind, more generous, more simple, and more true to the divine plan of things. Thus it is that religion has come to be considered almost as the actual voice of the soul in human affairs. It is that part of the soul's philosophy which has been already established in man in defiance of the pressures of materialism. You can see it, the war going on now between Dionysus and the Titans. The struggle of industrialism, of materialistic philosophy and policy against that part of man's nature which wants to believe in the beautiful and the good. We see nation after nation and individual after individual sacrificing everything, including life, to preserve the principles that to them are more important than living. So with each of these things in our mind, we can sit back and look a little bit. We can go to work and try and see what we can find out that will help us to escape from this treadmill that we have created for ourselves. And when we do it, we will become again as little children. And we will know the meaning of the words that blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. We shall find gradually that what we call growing up in materialism was a false growth, a delusion. We have not grown up, we have simply grown old. We have not grown wiser, we have become more skillful and therefore more dangerous. The great values have not been nursed. We are still vain, we still try to save the weakness of the inside by polishing the outside. We are still believing that appearance is everything. We are still trying to get ahead in a world which will never get anywhere in the long run. But we hope, or many people hope, that it will be here long enough for them to build their little careers before the big career falls apart. This type of thinking is hard on individuals. It's hard on ourselves, it's hard on our families, it's hard on our communities, and it is fatal to our political electional system, because we elect what we think will do the most to keep our own material interests alive. So out of all of this, we can start right on back and decide more or less as Socrates did, and also Diogenes, that we just got off on the wrong foot. We got off somewhere when the caveman began to throw rocks at each other. Then this trouble began. And from that time on, the world has been divided into a vast majority of people who believe propaganda, and a few who do not. And the few who do not are the ones that must gradually become the leaders of human thought. They must be the ones who can transcend the common, selfish self-centeredness by which we are all suffering keenly, whether we realize it or not. Actually, therefore, we need our toys back. We need the joy of simple living. A lot of people try to go back to nature. Every once in a while, one of our friends comes in and says, "Well, I'm going back. I'm going up in the wilderness. I'm going to stake out 15 acres, and I'm going to live there in peace the rest of my life." Well, everybody wishes them well and pats them on the back and hopes the taxes won't force them out of it anyway. And about a year later, the fellow's back. He said, "I couldn't stay any longer up there. I was going crazy." "Why were you going crazy?" "Because there wasn't anyone to talk to. There wasn't anyone to do anything with. I didn't even get news." And before it was all over, they moved back here because they were dependent on a diet of misinformation. They were dependent upon the opinions of people who knew no more than they did, and sometimes less. And they were also deprived, finally, from the ability to complain about things as they are. With therefore nothing left to do, they had to come back and take on the heavy burden that they thought they were going to give up. Now, this happens in every life. When we start to try and think better, live better, rise above conditions, we do find that it requires a considerable adjustment in ourselves. And time has proven more and more that this adjustment is best when you do not walk out on humanity. The moment you go off by yourself with the birds and the bees, you are not able to face the challenge of living. You're not going to learn much anymore. You're going to rusticate. You're going to settle back and just simply wait for the gradual disintegration of your vehicles. There's nothing much to do. Well, if you were back in the world fighting out something you believe in and changing your own life to meet the principles you hold to be true, you'd have a reason for existence. We have no reason for existence except the need for growth. And if we artificially block that need, then life again becomes meaningless. Everything depends upon man's personal adjustment with the problems which concern him most. So we watch a little bit and we observe that both the Oriental and the Occidental mystic, both of them have developed what is probably the best answer to it all. They have decided simply to ignore the Titans. They are going to not have any more dealings with those nasty giants who are always making trouble. And they are doing it by gradually quieting the titanic factor in themselves. And this is done by various meditational exercises, by mystical attitudes, by prayer, and by a gradual increase of understanding about life. They find it's the only answer to get rid of this confusion is to wipe the slate clean of everything that is difficult or dangerous to our own survival. Now we can say, "Well, you can't do that entirely. How am I going to forget the fact that my husband went off with another woman? How are we going to do this?" Well, you'll have to do it sometime, even if it takes death to do it. You will also have to realize that you are perpetuating a tragedy in yourself when something has been closed and sealed off by circumstances that are no longer to be changed. Therefore, you've got to get rid of the thinking that is constantly tying you back to the level of life which you want to escape from. If you want to compete, you can compete, but you can never have a life that is free from competition that way. If you want to dislike people, you can dislike them. But you will never grow any higher in your understanding as long as the dislike remains. If you want to blame others for your misfortunes, you can do so. But as long as you do that, your own growth cannot develop. the idea that a philosophy will take away all of these defects of character is foolish. Because you can meet on the street almost any day an individual with very high convictions who is living miserably. Because they've never lived their own convictions and have defended their position on the grounds that other people were responsible for their misfortunes. So you have to start in by building a new pattern. And one way, of course, you can gain something for this is trying to understand a little better things you have taken for granted. Try to go back, as Pythagoras taught, and see if you can really find the reason for a difficulty that has plagued you for half a lifetime. See who was really to blame. And if the person was to blame, how much of the spirit of forgiveness did you use? You are told in the scriptures to forgive your enemies. How many do this? Not too many. But no one who hasn't forgiven an enemy can grow any further. Those problems that hurt and destroy character must be solved before a person can go on. I think we can see this in something that is happening today, which is rather sad and disappointing in a sense, and that is that there has been a tremendous increase in religious awareness. People have moving into hundreds of different groups and sects, all of which are supposed to assist the person to grow, usually in either mystical or psychical terms. Many of these sects really overdo it a little bit, for they promise that the individual who joins them will grow. But no group can promise growth to a person who will not outgrow his own weaknesses. No organization can bestow a formula or a belief that can overcome selfishness in your own heart. And you cannot go on to the higher until you have conquered the lower. Otherwise, you're going to get into these complications that come to me so often. The individual trying to be more than they are, bound to the lower by a whole mass of tangled attitudes, and at the same time trying to soar off to nirvana. It just won't work. And anyone who thinks it will work is in for a very serious disappointment. Illumination does not correct your mistakes. Illumination comes to you when you have corrected them yourself and have outgrown the weaknesses by which you are bound to the level of consciousness that you at present occupy. As you grow and overcome things, your horizons broaden. The light grows stronger. If you cast off the ballast of your own mistakes, you rise in higher atmosphere. Little by little, the very correcting of your mistakes opens the way to enlightenment. But there can be no enlightenment conferred without dedication to principles. And dedication means not acceptance, but living those principles in your own daily relationships with other people. So try to get firmly fixed that you should more or less clean the slate, get back to basics, get back to foundations, and begin to build beauty. Begin to build a world of gracious things that you hope you will sometime live to see. A little girl having a doll finds it a great help in many respects. Finds it in it a companionship that no earthly person can give. This child gives this toy a life, makes it real. It knows the body's made of sawdust, but this doesn't affect the fact that to the child, the symbol is that of friendship, of association, of intimacy. The child taking that little doll to bed isn't afraid of the dark anymore. It is something that becomes a symbol of a relationship with other things besides self, a relationship that has not yet been touched by selfishness. And then suddenly, maybe, for one reason or another, the doll gets broken. And it is broken in most cases, because ultimately the doll symbol is wiped out by the so-called factual symbol. Instead of a world of little dolls that love us, we arrive in a world of all kinds of people who really want to impose on us or do various things to hurt us. But at the same time, it is much better that we have somewhere this concept of friendship and reality. For the Christian, the infant Jesus is the forever toy. It represents the noblest, most idealistic, most sacred of all infancy. It represents the true meaning of the love of God. It represents the true meaning of the birth of a being in whose love we all share. Therefore, it is a toy in a sense, but it is a divine toy. It is a toy that reminds us of the real beauties of existence. It is a toy that ennobles us and gives us a foundation in the wonder of the infancy of the Lord. This type of thinking helps, but it doesn't do it all. It can't take the place of action. But this type of toy and its effect upon consciousness does affect action. It helps us to strengthen the ideal of the moment when problems arise. The presence of the great world teachers in their various philosophies and teachings are moral supports in time of doubt and trouble. They will help us to make fewer mistakes. They will prevent us from corrupting whatever virtues we have left. And in time, through the advancement of these improvements, we see our way. Buddha on one occasion said that he could take a person by the hand and he could lead them. But he could lead them only one step. But that was all that was necessary. If the individual corrects one fault thoroughly, if he overcomes one fragment of ignorance completely, if he dominates one negative attitude in himself just once as the result of the teachings of the Buddha, if from those teachings he has one little experience of the blessedness of kindness and friendship, he has already taken the first step. And from that time on, he should by all means simply listen to his own heart. He will enjoy what he has done and will have the courage to do more. From the one good deed, he will get the key to the entire future and destiny of his own universal existence. So in each of these symbols, we have a toy in a sense, but it is a magnificent symbol of something we all want to try to be or to do. It is an advancement that is in the realest part of ourselves. So actually, all of these symbols come to us as an invitation to correct our own mistakes. To just settle down each day, each month, each year, to search for that which is good. This is also another phase of the effect of these attitudes upon the magnetic field of the body itself. Wherever the individual lowers his level of understanding and insight, even temporarily, the light in him shines less brightly. The magnetic field is disturbed by every attitude that we have, and it recognizes only two kinds of attitudes, good and bad. It doesn't recognize righteous indignation any better than it recognizes unrighteous indignation. It does not take attempt or make use of any negative, except that negative damages the magnetic field. It is damaged whenever a destructive attitude is nursed, where criticism, condemnation, and constant antagonism arises, where these arise in the person. His own health is endangered. No individual with a negative mental attitude is truly healthy. He gets along sometimes because the body perseveres. But he is not healthy unless his thoughts are ideal and beautiful. And if he wants to have at least a decent span in this world, he must learn to recognize and accept the constructive aspects of the problems he faces every day. If he does not accept them constructively, he is damaging himself. A neurotic is simply a person who takes the wrong attitude on a number of subjects. Not long ago, a psychologist had a rather interesting definition of this type of thing. He had a definition to divide a psychotic from a neurotic. According to him, a neurotic is a person who says 2 and 2 equals 5. And he will go to a practitioner to years to find out that that's true. Whereas a psychotic says 2 and 2 are 4, and I just can't stand it any longer. So the problem is all of attitude. It is, again, just the attitude of the person. And you watch people around you, especially those whom you care for and you wish good for, particularly. And you see these people relentlessly destroying themselves. You try to talk to them and they won't listen. And if they do listen, they disagree. And if they agree, they do nothing about it. They will not accept the fact that the fault is in themselves. So this is the first thing we have to drive home with everything we've got. Some may say, well, we might overdo it. There might be a few faults in other people that we have a right to resent. Well, there probably are faults in other people, but this can never be used as an excuse for one in ourselves. Because if we use that kind of an excuse, we'll never get any better. There are too many people with too many faults. So we have to reserve judgment and keep on working for the things we believe to be true. We have to realize that this material world is only a shadow of reality, that it is only a comparatively impermanent testing ground for souls. It is a place where we all have to learn how to become citizens of eternity. Every living thing has a destiny beyond its present state. What that destiny is going to be, we do not know at this time. A few may suspect, but they do not know. But every individual living thing, from a gnat in a sunbeam to the largest sun or solar complex, has a future destiny. It is going somewhere. It has come from somewhere. And it's on the way. Because of this type of realization, we have to try in every way that we can to make sure that we are on the way to that which is the next for ourselves. And I think we can tell pretty well that from how that goes, because every once in a while we see people, we see conditions in which good things do dominate. Every day we find there are unselfish people. Every time we read a newspaper, we may find there is selfishness, but we will also find heroic stories of people who have sacrificed everything for the common good. Everywhere there are things to admire, and the thing we want to do, if possible, is to become one of those admirable things. We want to be something that we can admire in ourselves. We want to rise above all of the delusions and confusions that have made life miserable. Actually, also, this quest for reality is probably the most perfect way of solving the problems of society as we know them today. The well-integrated person is not in debt. The thoughtful individual lives within their means. The kindly, well-intentioned, and wise person does not defraud others. All of the troubles that we have result from people who are breaking the rules of life. If we break the rules, we will have the same troubles. If we keep the rules we keep will keep us. And it's very important to realize this right away and every day. We are coming again and still into very troublesome and very critical periods in world history. We are coming to a time when integrities are going to be the most important thing in the whole world. We are going to be able to survive only because of what we do right. And we must do enough right to guarantee survival. But the good book tells us, of course, that though thousands fall on the right hand and thousands on the left, the just person shall not be moved. There is no way in which a person who has the insights and lives according to them can be destroyed. No event can destroy the just person. He can only be destroyed by injustice in himself, and if it isn't there, he cannot be destroyed. This does not mean that he cannot be taken out of his present physical body. But this, in turn, would happen to him anyway in the course of time. His life may be shortened by his consecrations or by his mistakes. But the individual who is right is a citizen of a universe that is right. And the good citizen is the final inhabitant of the divine plan of things, what Buddha calls the cosmic scope, or the great cosmic system, the communal system of the universe, is a world in which the citizens are those who have kept the rules. And they go on to the destiny that is theirs through the millions of years, if necessary, or whatever it is, that takes them to the time that they have awaited. There is no loss of a good deed. There is nothing to be gained by a bad one. Actually, we must keep all these opportunities and keep them clean. We must use all of our abilities to cherish and protect that which is good. We must love the beautiful. We must cherish that which is gentle and kind in itself. We must also recognize and protect the imagery of virtue wherever it appears. And we have to realize that it is our power, somewhere along the line, to bring life into things that we have learned to love. That too can come. For man is in the way to become a creator. A creator not only of problems, but a creator of solutions. So all this wonderful nursery in which we are, where we're all playing with something, where we're all imperfect, and where we are all hoping to get a little wiser, there is an absolute wonder of opportunity for people to help each other, to help each other to go along the right way, to make sure that we do not tempt people beyond their capacities, that we do not do things to them that causes them to resent us. We try our best to live according to rules that are right and proper. If we do this, there's no doubt in the world that it's going to be a lot easier for everybody. And every religion has taught this. Every person who says, "I am a religious person," has heard this, whether he's done anything about it or not. And today we have somewhat over 1 billion Christians, all of whom know the words of the Sermon on the Mount. They know what they are supposed to do. They know what they're supposed to be. But they have a strange feeling in themselves that they can break these rules with impunity. Or that if they do break the rules, nothing serious is going to happen anyway. This is not according to the best thinking. Regardless of whether we are punished for breaking the rules or not, we know in ourselves we have broken them, and that is wrong. We cannot have the same dignity of life if we compromise the rules of good living. We also know that among the other religions of the world, there are probably about 2.5 billion other people of other faiths who have the same basic dedications to principles. Therefore, we may say with reasonable safety that 4/5 of the population of the earth believe in right and wrong. They believe in integrities. They believe that there are powers in nature that reward the just and punish the unjust. They believe that they are part of a great system of universal love, and that this love will ultimately bring them to the ends of security and reality which they seek. Yet with all that mass of people who claim to believe, we cannot prevent a war. We cannot do anything to prevent the tremendous exploitation of human life. Somewhere there is a belief that is not working. There is a tradition, a dedication. An individual who has broken all the rules would die to defend them. It is a very strange situation, a very curious complication. But the only answer to the whole situation is to realize that we are here with the capacity to live in a beautiful world, that we are here to have all the good things happen that can happen. And we have been given a vast order of toys, playthings, by means of which we could gain educational progress. By understanding the smallest thing that exists, we share in a greater degree to all wisdom and all knowledge. We are living in the midst of infinite opportunity, not only to grow, but to have fun doing it. And somehow, for some reason, we seem to take all the fun out of it. We not only resent growth, we are afraid of it, and we are allowing superficial, false standards to lock us into an isolation which is causing mental and nervous illness and is destroying the natural reasons for living. So we hope that each person will try in one way or another to pick up the tattered toys in his own life and give them new dignity, and if necessary, put a new head on the doll and take care of it carefully, because it represents a part of a heritage of symbol opportunities and has been for someone and sometime a source of help in time of trouble. The sharing of our needs with real or imaginary playmates can be very important. It's when we are told that they don't exist anymore that we are in serious difficulties. So we hope you'll all believe in them at least until next time we're here 2 weeks from time.